Hi everyone, thank you very much for joining us on this week's episode of Lit Publishing's podcast, Lit Radio. My name is Miro, and as always, I will be your host for today's show. With me today is the author of The Wealth Elite, Dr. Rainer Zittelmann. How are you today?
Yes, fine, thank you.
It's great to have you here on the studio on this rather warm day in London. You've caught us, I think, on the warmest weather we've had this year. So thank you for taking the time. And of course, for those of you listening, Dr. Rainer is the author of now 19 books. He was previously a senior editor at Die Welt newspaper. Later, he became the leading communications consultant for the real estate sector in Germany. And material for this book is based on his second doctorate. And thank you very much again for joining us today on the podcast. And I want to start off with the question I ask any author that comes on here, and that's, what actually inspired you to begin writing, especially now that you've done it for so long and you have so much experience?
Yes, I started writing when I was 7 years old. You can find it last year in Germany. My autobiography was published, and to prove it, I have some pictures there where I was 7 years old writing. And the first thing what I did with 8 years, this was I sent a letter to the German Chancellor Willy Brandt. At this time he was Mayor of Berlin, but later he became Chancellor, and I was 8 years, and I was very interested in politics, and he wrote me a letter back, yes, and I was very proud, and with a picture and autogram by him with 8 years, so it started. And then when I was 10 years, I started with a newspaper at my school. First, it was about astronomy and about there were the first people landing at the moon at this time. Yes, I was interested in this. It was called like Galaktische Zeitung. And then later on, I was very leftist. It turned to the political left. Yes, I was like Maoist. Yes, Mao Zedong. And when I was 13 years old, I had this newspaper at my school. And so I started to write very early. And then my first book, this was my dissertation. My first doctoral thesis, it was about Hitler. It was when I was then 30 years old, and it's as well published in UK, and last year it was in the fifth edition in Germany. And so this was the first one, and now I have book number 21.
Wow, that's quite the story. And just out of curiosity, do you still have the Chancellor's reply from all those years ago, back when you were 7? Do you keep it?
Yes, I lost it, yes. But then when I wrote my autobiography, I asked the archive from the German Social Democratic Party, and whether maybe they should look for 1965 to find a letter of an 8-year-old boy, and they had such a great archive, they sent it to
Wow.
me. Yes, and I have it in my book, like a facsimile from his. And they informed me that there's evidence that he read it personally, because there was the draft for his letter, and then there were his handwritten corrections from the chancellor. And so you saw that he read it personally, whatever, and gave me this answer. Yeah, so I lost it, but it was found again.
But you found it. That's what's important. Absolutely. And let's focus on the book, and I would really like to get into the meat of the discussion, because The Wealth Elite is a groundbreaking study on the psychology of the super rich, and I think that's a topic that's not all that much discussed nowadays. There's a lot of talk in all sorts of, like you say, political spectra, social spectres, but the wealthy are often not really talked about in all that much regard. So can you perhaps tell us, what was the inspiration behind writing this very book? What made you want to go ahead and create it?
It was a couple of years ago, and I was writing another book. If you translate it in English, it would mean How to Become and Stay Rich. Yes, this was another book written by me. And in the time when I wrote this book, I looked for academic research or scientific research about this topic. And I found that there was not so much, only very less academic research. There's a lot of research about inequality, for example, and the reasons for this. But this was not what I'm interested in. I was interested in the personality traits and the behavior of rich people and what is different with them if you compare them with all of us, with other people. And I found one very interesting doctoral thesis on the University of Potsdam. This is near Berlin. And it was a survey about 470 wealthy people, the first academic research about it. And but they were not really rich as I see it, because they had on average net worth 1.4 million euro, yes. And okay, maybe for a lot of people, they are millionaires, they are rich, yes, but not in my definition. And this is the point that I should mention. The wealth research focused on firstly on individuals with high incomes. This was the first step. The term rich was used to describe individuals who earned 200% or 300% of the median income. And then the next step was researchers then went on to focus on individuals with net worth in the low single-digit million range. Like I mentioned this research project that was called Vermögen in Deutschland at the University of Potsdam, where they surveyed this 470 people with this medium net assets of 1.4 million. But one group that researchers have neglected is the group that I refer to as the wealth elite or ultra high net worth individuals. And what I mean is these individuals are those with a net worth of at least tens or hundreds of millions. Yes, and I think it's a big difference to explain it why. Yes, for a lot of people, millionaire may be rich, but I don't think so, because if he is able to get an interest rate after taxes, let's say 3%, and this is not so easy today, it means he will get 30,000 the year or 2,500 the month. And this is not like rich people want to live. Big difference is if you have 10 million assets and you're able to get an interest rate from 3% after taxes, then you have every month to spend 25,000 euro. Yes, and that's more how people think. Or if you have maybe 20 or 30 million, then you have 50,000 or 75,000 per month. This is how rich people are living. And I was interested in research about this group, the really wealthy people, who I call the wealth elite in my book. And there was nearly no academic research, not only not in Germany, but not in UK, not in United States. It was always more about this millionaire next door. And it is not easy to get these people, to come in contact with them and have interviews. And maybe this is the reason why there was no research, because this is not too easy.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Simply getting a hold of someone of that status would be a very difficult thing. And that's a very interesting point that you raised there. As you say, you know, there's only a very small amount of these people as well. And I often see in places like popular culture or media when you say this idea of the 1%. But then what's really interesting that within the 1%, there is another 1%, yeah, which holds even more wealth. And within that, there is another 1%, which holds even more wealth. So it's very interesting to see how, as just as you say, what someone might consider wealthy might be completely different from someone else considering what wealth is. And I really want to...
Exactly, yes. You can't say the exact number, yes, but the estimators around the world, these are maybe like 250,000 people, and maybe in Europe it's not exactly, but maybe it's something like 50,000 people. And if you have 500 million in Europe, yes, and then you can see, I think it's 0.01%. So we don't speak about the 1%, but we speak about 0.01%.
Yeah, now that's some maths to consider there for our audience to put into perspective. But now there's something that I'm really excited for us to hear from you. And that's a lot of the research, a lot of the methodology and interesting facts that you managed to, find out in your writing of the book. And perhaps you can take it away from us and tell us more about the research and how it all came to be.
Yes, maybe let me say first a few words about the method of my study, and later we come to some key findings. But first about the method. In absolute terms, the number of individuals with net assets in at least tens and hundreds of millions is so small that there is no representative sample. So we cannot use what you call quantitative methods. But you have to use what you call a qualitative approach and research for the study. I selected a qualitative approach, namely guided interviews. So I developed the framework of questions that serve to guide discussion and ensure that the topics I had selected were discussed during the interviews. And in relation to the genesis of individual wealth, it became increasingly clear for me that one of the areas my research should focus on was the personality traits that are the basis for financial success. So what I wanted to know was, which personality traits do the super rich share? What do they have in common? What distinguishes them, and what influence did these traits have on their financial success? And what I did then is I conducted 45 interviews, each lasting 1 or 2 hours, with individuals whose net worth in the lowest category, so the poorest one, they were between 10 and 30 million euros. Most of them were more than like 30 million euros, but this was the poorest category. In the highest category, they were from several hundred million to several billion euros. But the majority of the interviewees had a net worth of between 30 million and 1 billion euros. Most are self-made millionaires, and the group does, however, also include a small number of individuals who inherited wealth, but went on to significantly increase the net worth. So to put it in easy words, if someone maybe inherited 1 million and made 100 million out of it, yes, then it was interesting for my study. If someone inherited 100 million and made 10 million out of it, yes,
yes, absolutely,
then it was
yeah.
not interesting because yeah. you cannot learn how to get rich, only how to poor. So these were if they inherited someone, these were people who significantly could increase their net worth. And in the end, I had 1,700 pages, and in addition, each of the interviewees completed a so-called Big Five personality test with 50 questions. And I think it's the first time that such a number of ultra-high net worth individuals took such a personality test.
And that's very interesting there, Reina. And what you say about them being self-made really is, I think, very important, because I've read, and do correct me if I'm wrong, that when it comes to inheritance, when you have wealth which is passed down, it tends to actually shrink over time. And within,
absolutely,
within perhaps, you know, 3-4 generations, it can even disappear completely, where that's not the case with self-made wealth. It tends to stick.
Okay, it's correct. They have a special personality that help them to be rich, but whether their heirs have the same or not, yes, I think it's only, yes, in a few cases they will have, but most of the people think it's very hard to get a million or 10 million, but what they don't understand that it's much harder to keep it than to gain it, yes? And you will only learn it when you have it. Maybe I tell you something, it was only about the method, but I think our audience is more interested maybe now in the key findings,
yes,
in the results. And maybe first let me tell something about the background, where they came from, and most of the interviews come from middle-class families. However, it is striking that the parents of 6 out of 10 were self-employed. The parents were often entrepreneurs, had their own small business, or even were farmers, but mostly not rich. Not rich, but not working as employees, but self-employed. Thus, it was only natural that as children and young people, the interviewees expected to be economically independent later in life. The other 2/5 of the parents were professionals or civil servants, but only 2 had a working class background. So they were not rich, they were not a working class background, but middle class. And this social recruitment of the wealth elite differs fundamentally from that what the economic elite as revealed by previous research, because while the parents of senior managers in large companies mostly belong to the upper middle class and habitus has played an important role in their careers, but the selection process to join the ranks of the wealth elite are very different from those. It is not committees also who decide whether one belongs to the wealth elite, but it's the market. And maybe now I think what's interesting for some of you is how have they been at school and university? Maybe what do you think? What would you guess there?
I can have a few guesses in terms of I wouldn't say the knowledge, but the understanding of the free market is quite complex. So if any of our listeners out there are into this stuff and you're at school or university, let us know and get in touch on social media. We'd love to see what you think on this topic.
Yes, but I tell you what were my results. The school and university education were by no means a key factor. Most benefited from good school and university education, but in this they did not differ from many others, and in any case their performance was usually average. So one key finding from the questions asked during the interviews was that there was no correlation between the interviewees' achievements at school or university and the scale of wealth they went on to achieve. The interviewees who were the best at school or university were not among those with the very highest net worth. 1 in 3 of those who later became so incredibly wealthy had even not studied at university, and 1 in 7 had not even graduated from high school. And of far greater importance were their other activities outside school.
Now that's very interesting and something to ponder, and perhaps a very good question to raise in general in terms of Western society and the role of education, higher education, and what can be done to improve and perhaps change.
Yes, good question, but I think we shouldn't focus only on what we learn at university or school. And the good news is you have good opportunity to become rich, even if you were not so good at school or university. If you look at them, what experience was important for them, and what was very interesting for me, almost all of the interviewers were either competitive athletes or earned money in an atypical entrepreneurial way. So more than half were involved in competitive sports as students. As athletes, they learned to deal with victories and defeats, to assert themselves against rivals and competitors. They developed what is very important, I think, a tolerance for frustration and self-confidence in their own abilities, all things that you can learn doing the sports. And another point, it was particularly striking to learn how these wealthy individuals earned money alongside their school and university careers. So this typical student jobs, like when I was a student, one was a taxi driver, another worked in a restaurant. So generally spoken, to work for an hourly wage, yes. And this was the absolute exception with this people. Looking at their many ideas and ventures, it became clear how creative they were. For example, they sold everything from cosmetics to home winter gardens as when they were at school or university on the side, from used wheel rims to car washes, from used cars and motorcycles to insurance policies or real estate investment products, from animals they raised themselves to rings, from homemade radios to second-hand car radios, and all this stuff. You find a lot of examples in the book. And these experiences were clearly formative for the young people who later became entrepreneurs. They learned to organize, they learned to sell, and to think like entrepreneurs. And they learned, often unconsciously, and acquired this what I call the implicit knowledge. Yes, they acquired the implicit knowledge that is so important for successful entrepreneurs.
Now that's very interesting, and I think in a way there's also a lot of value in doing these things, especially in your early years, as it can teach you a lot about the value of resources, the value of money, and of course how to generate it. But I found it very actually fascinating that they even managed to raise their own animals and have their own stock to sell. I mean, that's absolutely fascinating. I've never heard anything like that.
Yes, and there's something to add, yes, I mentioned that most of them were self-employed, and sometimes, or let's say, they are difficult people. There's one research hypothesis that entrepreneurs are misfits. Difficult and rebellious employees who could never have climbed the career ladder within an established company. And this was confirmed for a number of the interviewers. They view themselves as difficult people, too nonconformist to submit to existing structures or other people. One of them told me if he would have to work as an employee, they should give him pills or drugs, because otherwise this was not possible. And this nonconformity was often evident as early as their school days. Many reported huge conflicts with authorities, especially with their teachers. I think you know this from other very, very wealthy people like Steve Jobs and so, yes, that they were very difficult. They were kicked out of school or university or broke up and so on. This was true for a lot of them, but not all. Yes, it's in addition to this group, there are others to whom this does not apply. This group had worked in large companies and risen up to the ranks. But however, the path at which their careers developed was too slow for them, or they felt that their earning potential was too low. One stated, I didn't want to wait 15 or 20 years to become CEO. It was everything too slow. And there was a third group. There was never even a choice between self-employment or employment. It was always clear to them that they would only work for themselves. Alongside their schooling and studies, they often earned substantial amounts from their ventures, including some who earned several hundred thousand Deutschmarks a year, what is as much as some 100,000 euros a year today. And this as someone who goes to school or as a student, it's amazing. And so if someone earned so much self-employed, he had never the idea to work as an employee later.
Yeah, and on that, I'd really sort of want to ask you something, because it's really interesting, as you say, that, you know, a lot of these people perhaps didn't feel that they belong within the school system or an employment environment where they would have to rise up through the ranks. And you mentioned the five personality traits on there, and of course the five main ones. But I wanted to sort of perhaps elaborate on that. Do you perhaps think that they had very high levels of disagreeableness, for example? Were they a lot more conscientious than other people, or did they perhaps feel that they just had more creativity? Was there any area there that really stuck out for you in that sense?
Yes, I mentioned this, that all of them took this Big Five personality test, and maybe I can I think this was your question to the results. Yes, and this Big Five theory is a psychological theory that we all distinguish with in our personality with five things. That is, first, conscientiousness, and this was the strongest personality trait, right, with them in the Big Five theory. Conscientiousness not only refers to what we might normally associate with this term, like sense of duty or thoroughness, but also means diligence, ambition, goal orientation, and so on. And the next thing is extroversion. This was also widespread among the interviews, although less so than conscientiousness. Of the interviews, 29 from 43 had high levels of extroversion. They described themselves, for example, as extremely optimistic people who prefer to go their own way. And the third personality trait is openness to experience. And this was also very widespread, with 28 of the 43 interviewers were very open to new experiences. And then there's another one that is called neuroticismen, how stable is your personality. And this was very low among the interviewers. And the last thing, this was one question, important question that you settled, is about how agreeable they were. And there's a hypothesis in entrepreneurship and wealth research that entrepreneurs and the wealthy are less agreeable. This was with the test, it was only partly confirmed. According to the Big Five test, agreeableness was far less pronounced than conscientiousness, openness to new experience, and extroversion. Nevertheless, according to the test results, a majority of the interviews demonstrated higher levels of agreeableness than expected. However, I had doubts as to whether the test questions, are not my test questions, it's a standardized Big Five test, but whether they could differentiate between more conflict-oriented and harmony-oriented personalities in business life. Yes, I had some doubts, and so the results of the test were therefore compared with the evaluation of the personal interviews. And during the interviewers were asked whether they would characterize themselves more as harmony-oriented or conflict-oriented, and taking the individuals are deemed to be conflict-oriented by the test, together with the interviewers deemed to be average or highly agreeable, but who describe themselves as conflict-oriented in the interviews, then you see half of them showed a tendency to low agreeableness and therefore be classed as more conflict-oriented. Seven had average levels of agreeableness, and 14 only were very agreeable. So these were the results in this from the test. And but maybe at this point you should know, for many of the interviews, the willingness to engage in conflict corresponds to the fact that they are contrarious and they enjoy opposing majority opinions and swimming against the stream with their investment.
And as we're talking on the topic of investment, and now that you've given us a great representation of what their personality traits are, I want to ask you a bit of a side question to that. And now that they've achieved all of this wealth, what does money even mean to them at this point? How do they view something like money?
Yes, a very important thing, because they were not all the same. I asked them a question about this. What does money mean? What does money mean for you? And there were different findings. Let's take a look in the book that I can find it. Yes, to develop a clear understanding of their motives, they were asked about the things they associate with money, and one motive to being able to afford the finer things in life, that mean like expensive cars, houses, or travel, played a very significant role, but only for 13 of the 45 interviewers, while 10 stated that this was not even slightly important to them. There was, example, one of the richest who stated that only one time, never in his life, he bought a shirt more expensive than 30 euros, and he spent only vacation one time in his life. So this was one extreme. But there were others who enjoyed having nice cars. But this was, in this case, they were really different. And then another thing I asked, security, how important was this motive, security? And it was important for half of the interviewees, because if you have so much money, you have more security than if you have only maybe 5,000 bucks on your bank account. And but all this was not what they had in common, but there was only one motive upon which almost all of the interviewers agreed. And then this was, they associate wealth with freedom and independence. This the desire for financial independence is shared by almost everyone who took part in the study. No other motive was rated as highly. Only five respondents gave a value which, on the scale of 1 to 10, was not in the highest range of between 7 and 10 points. And 23 even rated this motive of independence, freedom, with a maximum score of 10. So I think this what really drives them, that they don't have to work for someone else, and that then they can do what they like, and they don't have to work. They worked a lot, and some of them maybe really were workaholics, yes, but it's different whether you have to work to pay your bills or to pay your rent, or whether you only work because you like, you enjoy, you're ambitious. And this is what I call financial freedom. And this is really the difference, to repeat it, between what I call the millionaire next door, who has to work still, yes, because I gave you this calculation. If he gets an interest rate of 3%, he has only 2,500 euros or pounds. The the month, and this is not how rich people can live. But if you have this, for example, 50,000 the month without working, yes, then you don't have to work. But they work. But this gives them the feeling of freedom, yes, that they don't they decide what to do everything, and there's not someone else who decides for them.
Yeah, in a way, the money ends up working for them and they're not working for the money.
Yes.
Great. And there's an aspect of all of this fascinating research that you're telling us about that I think we haven't talked to about yet. And that's this idea of responsibility. And I've always found personally in my own life that the worst thing that you could possibly do for anything happening to you is to blame someone else, blame an external factor, blame something that was outside of your control, whatever it may be. And I guess it's my personal guess in terms of the wealth elite is that they were able to take responsibility for everything in their life, take responsibility for their action, for their failures, and for their success. Now, how do they respond to this idea of always being, you know, responsible?
Yes, I think this is one of the most important things that you mentioned here, because every one of them had, you know, serious setbacks and crises in their life, and the question is how did they react? And most people, you know, they play the blame game. If they are successful, that's them, yes. And if they lose, that's someone else to blame, for or their mother or the society or the teacher or their boss or their competitor or the market or however. And this is absolutely different with these people. A fundamental attitude, the interviewers demonstrated a fundamental attitude of not blaming external circumstances or other people for setbacks and crises, but looked for the cause of the problems they were facing in themselves. They never saw themselves as victims of circumstances or of the actions of their rivals. They always took personal responsibility for any problems, nor that they use negative market developments as an excuse for the difficulties they blamed themselves for misjudging the market. Maybe I give you some quotes here from the book, whether I find it now that makes it clear what I'm talking about. For example, there was one interviewee, and he said, I quote, "And that, I think, is where there are two types of people. The first group says, I didn't get enough money there and it didn't pay on time and the like. The other says, what mistake did I make? What did I do wrong? And the ones who say, what was my mistake and what chance do I have? They stand a good chance of getting things right and doing better in the future. You take responsibility yourself and can change things yourself. We are the mistake," he mentioned. "Everything that happens apart from serious illness and things like that, and even on that score you can debate whether we are to blame, you make your own bet and you have to lie in it, don't you? I had big problems when I was bringing up my son, and then I asked myself, what have I done wrong? Not what has my son done wrong. And on the very day that I stopped making the mistake I had been making, my son turned out fine." Yes, and this is very important that you are responsible. And another one, this was one of the richest interviewers. He had several hundred millions of euro, and what he stated was, I quote again, the setback itself maybe is a result of the market. Of course, you can say that it is nothing to do with you. It was the market. But at the same time, I also have to acknowledge that it was me who misjudged the market. It could well be that everyone else had misjudged the market, but that doesn't help me in the slightest. It's another example of what you asked at the beginning, that I ultimately have to be able to rely on myself. And it doesn't help me when others arrive at their assessments of the market and I'm as wrong as they are. I have to be able to stand for my decision, to be able to live with my decision. That's another reason, not to simply trust the masses, but to make your own decisions based on your own convictions. This is very important. Maybe we can speak later about this, that they like to swim against the stream sometimes.
Yes, please do elaborate on that, because in any sense, swimming against any stream is never an easy thing to do.
Sure, absolutely. I think, first of all, it's logical. If you do the same like everyone does, why you should become ultra high net worth individual or very rich? If you do the same things, you will get the same results, and you have to do things different.
The definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
And expecting a different result.
Absolutely. I think according to Einstein or so, he said this.
And, yep.
Absolutely. And you have to be different and you have to enjoy it to be different. For example, I have here a little bit funny. One of the interviewers, he stated this, I quote him, yes, I eat completely differently to everyone else. I sleep differently. I think differently. I have made it my absolute mission to think differently from everyone else. You know, this was one. Or the other one said, I have always been an outsider. I always did things that no one else would do. The others, they said, the economy will pick up. And I said, it's heading downwards. In 2 years, it will start to go down. So what can I do today to make sure that I'm well positioned when the economy starts to decline? Or here's one very funny example. And you know, the interviews were anonymous, but I only were allowed to mention one because there was an article in the most important German magazine, Der Spiegel, and he allowed me to mention that he was one of them. His name is Theo Müller. He started with 4 employees. Today he has 21,000. He's also in UK, very active, and he earned all his money with milk and chocolate and this stuff. So his example is sure it is about cows, yes, because he earned all his favorite favorite animals are cows, yes. And I quote him, and he said, there's a great example from farming. When a herd of cows comes to a fork in the road, and there's a beautiful green pasture on the left, which 100 cows head towards. And there's one cow that goes to the pasture on the right, where the grass is nowhere near as lush. And in no time at all, the 100 cows have grazed, their grass is gone. The lone cow might not have had the largest grass, but she could take her time and eat her fill and end up having more to eat. Yes, and so it's always, yes, go have the, you know, they enjoyed it to be what you call in investment, you call it contrarians. That doesn't mean that it's a guarantee for success, always doing the opposite of what the majority does. But a lot of them, they became very skeptical when they saw that the majority does something. It was not for them an evidence that they are right, but it was more like a red flag maybe to think about whether they are right or not. And they had absolutely no difficulty to do things different than other people.
Yeah, and that's very interesting. And I want to focus the conversation perhaps for a moment on yourself, because you've been a successful entrepreneur and you've led a consultancy and done extremely well for yourself. And now that you've written the book and you've done all this research and you have all of these results, do you follow the same pattern as the interviews? Have you learned anything from them, or have you seen perhaps a different way of doing things?
In a lot of points, I'm similar with them, especially what I was talking about the last thing, this swimming against the stream. I give you one example. For example, in 2004, I invested in, or in the beginning of the 2000s, I invested in Berlin in residential, and in this time, everyone who did was seen as extremely stupid because the performance of the real estate market was very, very bad, with low rents and no increase. There were even a decrease in prices for a lot of years. And everyone said, to generally spoken, to invest in real estate, it's not the best idea. In residential real estate, it's a crazy idea, and to invest in Berlin is a crazy idea. And I invested in this part of Berlin where it was most crazy, seen as most crazy. And I could, for example, I only give one example. I could buy a multifamily house with, I think, 25 or 26 units. So this is in Berlin or Köln, and it was very cheap at this time for, I think, 270 euros per square meter, or it was a multiplier of 6.8, what is amazing cheap. And the Deutsche Bank didn't want to finance it because they saw it as too risky, because no one did it. Yes, but I found another bank, and I had very high leverage, extreme, because I gave absolutely not 1 euro equity in this. It was like 120%. So everyone would say it's risky, but for me it doesn't seem any risk, because it was so cheap. And I had a yield of 15%, and so I took a high amortization of 6% the year, and after 10 years from this 1.2 million, their outstanding debt was only like 200,000. And then, but in the meantime, it was exactly the opposite attitude of what it was before. Everyone wanted to invest in Berlin, and especially there where I bought it, in Neukölln, what was the worst part of Berlin, and now it became so attractive for all international investors. And so I could sell the same property that I bought for 1.2 million, I could sell for 4.2 million. And because I had used no equity, I made from zero 4 million as an example. So I made some investments in this contrarian way. So when everything now is enthusiastic about the Berlin market and it's where you should invest, yes? So I started to sell, yes? And this in this way I'm similar, but on another way I'm not so, because they had much higher risk orientation than I had. I asked them on a scale from -5 to +5. -5 is someone who's very extremely risk averse, and +5 is someone who's prepared to take extreme high risk. Yes, and I asked them, "Where are you?" And most of them said between +3, +5. Yes,
right, very high.
But I'm not. Yes, I mean I'm maybe only one, and so this is different. So I found some things in common yes, like this contrarian approach, but on the risk orientation, I'm much different.
Right, right. And to follow up on that, Dr. Rainer, where will you be going from here now that the book will be out and you've done this great research on it? Do you perhaps have another project in the pipeline that you're going to be focusing on?
Yes, it's what I'm doing all over the day now. And I think in the end of the year, I will write the book and I hope it will be published. Or I think it will be published next year. And it's the first international study about prejudice and stereotypes about rich people. Because right. I'm reading a lot of psychological special interest magazines, books. There are thousands. I cannot read all this thousand, but I read a lot, yes, about research in prejudice and stereotypes. You know, there's a research, especially in United States, but in other countries as well, prejudice against black people, against Jews, against gay people, against women. Even there are some studies prejudice towards poor people, but there is not one study, big study, prejudice against rich people and stereotypes about rich people. And so what I will do now, we start in the next weeks international poll in United States, in UK, in France, and in Germany to compare it, the attitude of the population, of people in general, towards rich people. How do they think and feel about rich people? What stereotypes, what attitude, what prejudice maybe they have? This is the first poll. And the next thing we do is a media content analysis, quantitative research. We make this research, or we're doing this research in newspapers from all of these countries, like from Germany, from UK, from France, from United States, to look what picture of the rich is drawn in this media. And then I have another group. They analyze cinema films about the rich. Maybe some of you saw. Have you seen Titanic? This,
oh, yeah.
For example, with this wealthy man, very hard-hearted, and I think he dies in the end. And the very handsome but poor guy who and the pretty girl. Sure, first is with the rich, but then is with him, and so on. So there are a lot of stereotypes in cinema movies, and we analyze this, and I will put all this together. And I'm reading a lot about psychological theories, and in the end, this should be the book about how people see rich people, what kind of stereotypes, what prejudice. So what I did with this study with the wealth elite, I spoke with the super rich people, and now we're talking with other people who are not rich, and to find out how they see the rich people.
Great, fascinating stuff, and we'll be looking forward to seeing how the study turns out and what will be the very, I'm sure, interesting results from that. But I want to ask you one question, Dr. Rainer, which I ask anyone that comes on the podcast, and it's the question that we always want to finish off with because we think it's very important here on Lid Radio, and that's, what are you currently reading?
All about prejudice. All about prejudice. All about the last weeks. I read a lot of newspapers from UK. All what were about billionaire, super rich, and so on. But the last month, I read, for example, books that were very interesting for me about envy. Yes, there's a research in this, why people feel envy others or are jealous and so. And I think this is I read most of it is psychological stuff.
Yeah, very interesting stuff there. And of course, the Wealth Elite for anyone that's interested. There will be links in the description below where you can go and you can find out more about the book and, of course, more about the themes and discussions that we talked about.
Yes, maybe let me add one thing for, I think, for whom the book is interesting. I think it's for two groups, yes? There are some who say, I want to be rich and I want to know more about these people who did it. But please don't look for an easy way like guarantee or recipe. You have to do these five things and then you get rich. There are a lot of books you can read about this. I think I read a lot of them and most of them are crazy for stupid people and people who believe that it's so easy with these 5 points and then you'll be rich. Yes, I think they will never be rich. But on the other side, I think it's not a bad idea if you want to become rich or not only rich, in anything you will like to be successful on average, to speak with people who always have reached this aim that you are looking for. And if you don't know so many billionaires or people with hundreds of millions self-made, and I think most of the people don't know them personally, I think that it's not a bad idea to learn how these people think. But it's not only a book for people who want to be rich. I know a lot of readers who only were interested because it is a minority in our society, and I think it's always interesting to learn more about minorities. They have a different life, and I was always interested in this topic, minorities. And this is a minority. We spoke about this 0.01% of the people, and how are there? Only maybe not you. Maybe you don't want to get rich. Not everyone want to get rich, but maybe you are only curious. How? What are these kind of people? How do they think? Maybe you have yourself some stereotypes or prejudice. Like, for example, you look in TV and you see them always only drinking champagne and with their fancy cars and so. But I will tell you, this is only part of a reality that is shown there in TV. And there's another part. It's much more complex. And these people have some things in common, but I also show they are different. Not everyone is like the other. Like I have, we talked about it. How important are the finer things of life for them with cars and so on? I mentioned that for some of them they're very important, for others not. And so, some people maybe only curious to learn more about this minority. And for these people, I've written this book.
Great, there you go. Fascinating. And of course, for our audience, do check it out. There's some absolutely great insight there. And I would like to thank you very much for taking the time, Dr. Rayner. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you here in the studio.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure for me.
And of course, to our audience, thank you very much for joining us today on Lit Radio. You can find us on our social media channels at Lit Radio. We always look forward to your feedback. And if you enjoyed our conversation today, please reach out. Tell us what you think. And we would love to have your feedback. And I very much look forward to seeing you next week.